Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Sunday, April 27th, 2014, episode number 55. All hail the Queen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. I'm Kevin England. The height of spring is upon us in central New Jersey, and the excitement of the local beekeepers is palpable. This is the time of year that beekeepers plan for. The hard work of winter in the workshop, freshening up equipment in the anticipation of the blossoming trees and flowers. The nervous energy of first-time ever beekeepers, trepid with apprehension about entering into the fraternity. The aura of spring is magical. It's been even more pronounced this year as beekeepers anticipate the season like fishermen waiting for opening day. But in the northeast region of the United States, well, we've been beset with cooler than normal temperatures. Some of the plants are not waiting, and right on cue that they are displaying all their splendor, but our girls are confused at the temperatures in the morning, which are not warm enough to take advantage of the burgeoning forage. It has been an odd start around here, and as you'll hear in the local hive report, that it is even more true to form in our local apiary. Let me stop waxing poetically and get to business about this episode that we are about to embark on. I have some insights to share about queen quality, courtesy of a talk from David Tarpey. Some beekeepers are thinking splits to make new bees and prevent swarming. We've covered splits on the podcast before, but for this episode, we'll go through a little refresher. Beekeepers get evangelical sometimes about equipment and the items that they swear by. We'll talk about one such piece of equipment and encourage you to weigh in about it. The slatted rack. Is it a gadget or a crucial piece of equipment? We'll go through a quick editorial. For Roundtable, I have a few things to cover. Why? I'm going to comment on a witness behavior and ask the age-old question, why? Misuse of lip balm for kicks? Oy. There's an app for that? Probably is, and therefore I need your help. And other things on the pile, pollen color guide, and a reminder on the International Queen Marking Colors. Maybe along the way we'll sneak some other things in, but enough is enough. Let's get started with the local hive report. For the local hive report, let's recount where we were at the ending of last episode. Went into winter with three hives plus one, might as well call it a nucleus-style hive, sitting on top of a full deep. And unfortunately, only one hive survived out of that stash, and it was in reasonable shape, but not really sure where it was because it was cold and we didn't get to open it up. Had the opportunity recently in a 65-degree day to crack the cover and go in and take a look. And we had looked at it about 3 weeks ago. There was a stash of bees right up against the inner cover in amongst the food supply, but we weren't sure if that was the real cluster or the cluster was down below. Unfortunately, the finding was that there was no colony inside this hive when we finally opened it up. We were hoping for the best, that one colony would survive the winter and that we would have something to get started with in 2014, but come to find out that the colony was empty. And that's kind of strange because a couple weeks ago bees were coming and going with pollen, but it seems that the queen was out of commission. I went and looked at the colony, I think it was somewhere about April 15th, and did not find any existence of a colony, no brood pattern, no bees to speak of, except this little cluster of bees sitting on the bottom board. I looked really close at them, but didn't get to see a queen in there, and thought, well, everything that was traipsing in and out of that hive looked to be there for the purpose of robbing it out, and they were the neighbor bees back for some more in the spring to insult our intelligence. I won't go into that story again. So, you know, we closed everything up, left it be in disgust, and walked off for the day. Went back a couple days later to break it all down, opened it up, and went through and looked one more time. And lo and behold, who was sitting on top of the frame but the queen? It was one lowly little queen with about 8 bees around her, and that was the existence of the hive. They had gone back to nothing, and she apparently was out of gas. And why they didn't replace her in the fall or you know, late last summer, I'm not sure, but they opted not to. They went through the winter with her, and she got to spring, and she was useless. So, had the debate about what to do with her, and with no other colonies to speak of, I just basically left her in there and left them to dwindle. I suppose I should have really just taken her out, put her aside in some alcohol or something, and made a swarm lure out of her, but not thinking straight about the situation, facing the prospect of being completely beeless. Now, I could tell you psychologically that is, it's just a really disheartening prospect. After years of having bees, making things over winter, being up to a reasonable number of colonies, to dwindle down to literally no colonies left, it just makes you think about your foundation in the world and how life goes. And I hope that I've demonstrated that I kind of have a concept about all this, and it seems really strange and weird to have a setback. But ever persevering, I am thinking that this is going to be the beginning of a 2014 new fresh start. So yesterday was Earth Day here, the celebration at least, for the Hunterdon County area. And we had a beekeeping meeting next door at our mentoring hives. And the meeting prospect was for splits, and we split the hives at the mentoring hives and made a number of nukes. That location is off in a field somewhere not local to us, and it would be easier if those nukes were under surveillance of someone, and since I don't have any colonies, I brought 3 of them home and have them sitting out in the yard. I'm going to work on building those colonies up for the Beekeepers Association so they'll have them for the spring, and perhaps I'll steal, borrow, beg a frame or two to make my own nuke and get restarted. I'm also following the prospect of putting swarm traps out. And, you know, an epiphany came about. You know, I was thinking about, do I have the equipment and can I go into my garage and start building swarm traps? And then I thought to myself, duh, you have all this equipment sitting there with brood frames and all that. They're natural born swarm traps. So starting to make connections through the network in the community to go out and just place empty hives at random locations in hopes of collecting swarms. So here we sit with 3 nucleus hives sitting out in the apiary. They're full of bees and they are not loaded with queens. The prospect is to make new queens out of what was there. And this hive that they were generated from, in particular, is survivor stock over the last 2 years. So it's local queens. They're very prolific, and we're hoping to perpetuate that. And we'll feed these and let them raise their own queen, and we'll get them started for the 2014 season. And then in June time frame, we'll make more and just keep building bees, and that's the premise of these. So the funny thing about it is I brought these home yesterday, set them out. There was a thunderstorm rolled through. It was about 70 degrees in the afternoon yesterday. Let them out, and they did not come out until this morning. And the funny thing about New Jersey is it's been cold. Cold. When I say cold, it was 24 degrees last week, I think on Tuesday in the morning. And it's been 30s and 40s in the morning. That's not normal now. We're supposed to be in an area where they should have temperatures that they can break out in the morning and get to forage. And if you look at the trees and the forage available, the daffodils have been out for a couple weeks. The dandelions are in the yard. The forsythia has bloomed. And you're starting to see all the flowering on the trees. The buds are about to break and the little leaves are showing on the maples. And yet it's cold in the morning. This is a strange year. If you recount in the last episode, we talked about how cold it's been and colder than normal. And we had an extremely, by New Jersey standard, harsh winter. And that pattern continues, and we all keep having this conversation about how we're going to be cold, 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 and all of a sudden it's going to be 90 degrees. So that being said, the bees are not foraging in the morning, and a lot of beekeepers are scratching their head around here wondering if they're missing the nectar flow. For me personally, I've been watching the weather, and it's amazing how you become a beekeeper weather forecaster. It looks like next week, and here's a thought that I have that I'll share with everybody. You see all the buds come out on the trees, and you see the flowering plants start to flower. But I think it really takes a week or so for those to open up and get really prepared for the bees to come in and pollinate. So last week was that breakout. You started seeing flowers everywhere, different types of flowers, trees blooming. Some of them have come and gone, and yes, the bees have been foraging on those. But for the most part, next week will be the week in New Jersey where everything is going to come to fruition for the spring nectar flow, and it's going to be game on. The other thing that I know from the New Jersey Swarm Report is no one has reported a swarm yet. So it seems like we're off to a really slow start here in 2014. I'm excited to have bees in the apiary again. Even though they're guests, we'll give them tender, loving care, and we'll just talk about how they're doing and growing. I certainly have stores for stuff that we had left over in the apiary from overwintering, and I have honey and whatever pollen to feed them. So we'll be getting them up to speed, and we'll just keep letting you know of their progress. So local hive report done. Let's head into segment number one. Before I do, let me give some contact information. First off, our website is www.bkcorner.org. There you can find a listing of all of our episodes along with a table of contents that kind of gives you the time frames of the different topics that have been disclosed through the various episodes. And you will find the show notes for this one, which is episode number 55. In addition, you can send an email to us, and we encourage you to do that. Kevin@bkcorner.org. Again, I apologize for those who have sent emails and didn't get their responses yet. I've been getting to them recently, but haven't gotten through the backlog. You know, busy days, busy nights, I guess springtime. One of the comments we were having yesterday while we were at Earth Day celebration in the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers booth is everything happened yesterday. It was like the official start to the year of being outdoor activities, and when I say I'm busy, I think everybody on Earth is busy at this time frame in this region, so I guess we're not alone. When you want to check things out from a Facebook standpoint, social engineering, you can go over to facebook.com/beekeeperscorner. I did get a lot of response, good response, out of what you would do for the questions that we posed out of last episode. They were pretty interesting. Thank you everybody for the contributions there. And it was a good sampling and a good mix of how people approach things. And it's always interesting and refreshing to see that there's a lot of different opinions and ways to go about it. And I tend to see that things are a bit regional. Certain areas do things certain ways. And I guess a lot of that comes by culture. A lot of it comes by regional practice and temperatures, and just basically, well, you can think also about where you live and the type of habitat you have available to you, but always interesting to hear people weigh in. As long as you all behave, I appreciate it that everybody maintained decorum when there were differences of opinion. The YouTube channel has been overtaken by events, but actually I have a number of videos to put up there, and we're producing them soon. I actually had lost some videos from February, but was able to go back and reclaim them from a backup, so I'm really happy about that. That happened this morning. I was very nervous that I lost some of them and glad my backups work, so had a corrupt disk and was able to recover and did not lose some things, so public service announcement, do your backups of your computer stuff. All right, let's go. Segment number one. Segment number one is our feature for this episode. It's called All Hail the Queen. What if you were to explore the notion that good strong qualities are directly related to quality queens? How cool would it be to know that if you had a good queen, you'd have a better chance of productive colonies if you could count on better queens as a rule? You know, that being said, what if you could turn back the clock and compare queens of today to queens of yesteryear? How would things measure up? David Tarpey, a well-known speaker on a number of beekeeping topics, is an associate professor and extension apiculturist in entomology. If you've ever had the chance to see him speak or to invite him in, you should make provisions to do so. He's a dynamic speaker, he has a wry wit, and just about any topic that I've seen or heard him present on has been easy to follow and well thought through and presented to the general audience. You know, such was the case in a presentation he gave at the American Beekeepers Federation conference in Hershey that I attended. On that day, he was speaking about queen quality and a little venture that he took to compare samples from today's queens to see if it correlated to queen quality, to see if a correlation could be made about queen quality in the documentation of queen notations of past. I didn't say that very well. Today's queens versus the old ones. That was a Kevin moment. I'm going to summarize what he shared, and then I'm going to provide a link to where you can follow the direct talk and hear it in full detail with the supporting evidence that he provided along the way. So what about that notion? It's something that beekeepers I know today postulate on. Are our queens worse off today? Are they duds compared to the glorious beauties of our beekeeping forefathers? How actually might one look at that question and come up with an answer is a good thought. So let me put a pin on that and come back to that in a second. Dave shared that they sampled 136 queens from commercial providers. The premise of the review at hand was to suggest that the colony level phenomena is directly tied to the quality of the queen. Maybe insights could suggest why anecdotally beekeepers are reporting frequent requeening, supersedures, seeing drone layers, and really, what happened to the days where queens lasted years and years. So if you had to come up with a test, what might you do? In this case, what they did was took the parameters that are reasonable to look at when considering what makes a good queen. So what are they? Physical queen attributes, parasites, disease, insemination, and mating quality. The fundamental approach is going back to the documented research records and comparing the history of queen facets to what you find from today's queens. What the team did that worked on this was comparisons from a qualitative aspect. So the first thing they looked at, body size and body attributes. Now, queen's only as good as what comes out of her ovaries. And the queen's ability to provide eggs is a fundamental component of her longevity and the quality of her offspring. Findings in the past demonstrated that 8% of the queens had underdeveloped ovaries. Comparing that against the current day sample set, it remained about the same. Present day, past days, it remains consistent, move along, nothing to see in the ovaries. Nosema and tracheal mites. So looking at the percentage of queens with nosema from the past and to today, in the past it was said that 10% was the norm. And yes, queens are subject to nosema, but today's sample, and I think I said 136 queens were sampled in this particular, oh no, I didn't get to that, 136 queens were sampled in this sample study. And today, there is no sign of nosema. So how cool is that? We're better off today in the nosema topic. Now, tracheal mites? You don't ever hear anyone talk about tracheal mites, but in the past, this was something that was of concern. And 1/3 of the queens in the past, in the studies I looked at, were compromised with tracheal mites. In the sample of 136 that they looked at, there were only 3 that had tracheal mites present. So looking at nosema and tracheal mites, they don't appear to be a factor. In fact, we seem to be better off today than days of yore. So what about mating numbers? Dave talked about insemination quality and how much sperm was present. In 1962, and the reason he brought this up is that how do you assess how much sperm is in a spermatheca to say that this queen is quality mated? A benchmark study from 1962 sent the benchmark. That's why it's a benchmark. that was a Kevin moment, too. I'll keep going. Anything less than 3 million sperm present is a poorly mated queen. So 29% of the queens were under that threshold in 1962. That's the data. Done again in 1984, a different study found 11%. And the outcome for 1988, when repeated again, was 19%. So 29%, 11%, 19%. What about today? Contemporary queens worked out to be 19%. So they're in the ballpark, not a problem here. Physical mating numbers with drones. In past studies, I'll cut right to the point, it was a dozen drones on average. Today, dozen drone on average. Same number. No change there. So perhaps there were more, but the conclusion was, at the end of this little segment of his own, is that there's really nothing to see when it comes to parameters and facets. The things that they looked at, the queens of today, are in measure with the queens of yesterday. So if queens are on par, at least with the ones in the past in this 136 sample, then what should you look for in a good queen? What physical and mating characteristics make a difference, and what else could be at play? So he went into detail about an interesting concept, and I'll just kind of paraphrase what it was. Think about a colony that's going to make a queen, and let's propose that the queen went missing and cover what would happen. The colony would strike out to make a new queen, of course, and they would pick a larvae that is 2 days, some say three, or younger, and they would make a queen out of it. And the queens would gestate, and eventually new queens would emerge, and they'd go get mated and take on the responsibility of the colony. But there's a little more to the dynamic of that. So if you think about it, a queen that is made from an egg that was 2 days old, theoretically is older, and when it emerges, it will have a 2-day head start on an egg that was an hour old, if that's the comparison. So the folklore, or the common wisdom, is that the first queen to emerge goes around and kills off all the other queen cells so that she can be the queen. In study, it's not exactly done that way. The queen that is built on day one, which is a 2-day old larvae, and the one that is 1 hour old, they may build, let's say, a half dozen queen cells, and there'll be a half dozen queen cells running at any given time. What they found is that the colony regulates this, and not all queen cells that start out as a potential queen make it to the point where the queen emerges. The colony will systematically, at times, go through and kill off some of those queens, tear them down. Maybe they know something that we don't, and that queen that's in there is inferior or something's wrong with it. So that's an interesting prospect, that not every queen that is chosen makes it to the finish line and emerges. Secondarily, if that 2-day head start comes out, and that queen is going to go out and tear it down, maybe the prospect is that the queen that was a 2-day old larvae. No, let me say that right. Slow down, Kevin. I'm going to go back to a different point. Eggs are laid, and queens are chosen to be made out of those eggs. A fresh egg, brand new egg, just laid by the queen, makes a better quality queen than an egg that was 2 or 3 days old. If an egg was chosen that was 2 days old, and that colony is eager to have a queen, they may let it through, but the quality of that queen, as it's been established, will not be as good as one that was fresh and hours old. So if the two-day egg has a head start and gets out first, how does a colony regulate that the best queen wins? Sometimes they just want a queen and let it go. And other times they corral the queen and let different queens emerge. And then eventually they either take care of that two-day egg that became the queen and dispatch it, or they let them fight it out and may the best one win. So that's an interesting prospect, that there's a backstory in the background going on about how queens are raised inside the colony. And I'm going to now make the point that you should go listen to this, and I'll provide a link in the show notes, because David did a far better job explaining it than I did. But the fundamental premise here is that queen quality is a byproduct of which egg was chosen and how the bees let it happen. And that's a fascinating aspect that I never knew about. So coming back to the conclusion that David had, there were some interesting concepts. One is, bigger is better. You know, wider is better for Pontiac. Well, bigger is better for queens. It's a simple fundamental mathematical equation. A bigger queen with a bigger abdomen has a bigger spermatheca and can hold more sperm. And the ovarials will hold more material. And what they've shown in correlation is literally a bigger queen provides better colony. They have better crops of bees, better foraging habits, better colony numbers, and they have longer lifespans. And I don't want to know that I'm making some of that up, but generally his commentary was bigger was better. And again, I'll encourage you not to listen to me, but to go back and listen to it. You know, so that's an interesting aspect. And when I looked at that little runty queen that made it through the winter but only had 8 bees around her and had run out of gas, thinking to myself how dumb I was that I didn't replace her in the fall. But she had made such prolific patterns all summer long. I guess I can't kick myself too hard, but I'm really frustrated that she ran out of gas in the fall and didn't overwinter in the spring. She was there, but not very useful. So had I known this insight then, I think I would have taken a different path. But I'm on a tangent here. Anyway, so this is a fascinating thing when you say, all hail the queen. The colony is only as good as the sum of its parts, but the queen is certainly an important part of it. And I think, as I've said before, one of the themes we have in 2014 is pay attention to your queen. How well was she mated? Maybe you can't tell, but hopefully she was mated well. But is she a quality queen? Is she a big queen? Is she a productive queen? And I'm getting to the point to believe that if a queen is not, if it's not a year old or no older than 2 years, then you can leave it. But if it's getting to the 2 year mark, it's time to replace it. And that's my stance on that. So we'll provide a link in the show notes to David Tarpey. You can find this on the abf.net. Wait, abfnet.org, I believe, is the website for the American Beekeepers Federation. It's the 2012 recordings, and the recording is an mp3 file called Better Queens, Better Colonies. And again, a plug for David Tarpey. He speaks quite frequently. From what I've seen, there's a lot of things in different sessions, and if you're going to a conference and a lot of people are speaking, by all means make sure you get to the David Tarpey sessions. This is a time of year where a lot of beekeepers talk about splits and split fundamentals. The first thing I say about this topic is there's a million ways to do a split. One of the more popular notions in the world is if you have a brood box that spans two deeps through the top of one and the bottom of another, you can literally just break that box out, put one of them on a bottom board with a new inner cover or outer cover, and they will make a new colony if they have eggs that are 2 days or younger. That's referred to as a walkaway split, but sometimes you want to be a little more predictive in that matter. So let's talk about a couple things. The first thing you need is you need a high population of bees and a working queen. A hive that's destined to procreate is going to be loaded with bees. They start out in winter and look to get to critical mass so they can cast off a swarm. And there is a reason in itself to do a split so that the bees stay in the family, so to speak, because you really don't want them flying the coop if they're going to swarm. The larger the split, the faster the parent and the child will recover when starting with a large subset of bees to begin with. Of course, you want to make splits out of disease-free, non-parasitized hives. You need to have healthy bees. And you need to have brood. You're going to want a brood population of brood frames, both open and closed, in order to perform the procedure. One other thing about the brood is you need boys. Because at some point, you're either going to buy a queen and put it in a box, or you're going to have them raise their own queen, and in order to do that, they're going to need drones. At this time of year, in the United States, you should be seeing drones emerge, and in the hive we were in yesterday, there were drones all over the place. So where does a queen go? I guess the first fundamental question before you ask about which way to go with the queen is, can you find the queen? And if you can, consider taking the queen to the new hive with a frame of brood. Now, there are different schools of thought, so don't flame me about making that comment, but if you think about an artificial swarm emulating what is going on in nature the old queen leaves the hive and leaves it to her daughters. So fundamentally, a traditional split, I would say, is going to take the original queen out of the hive and move her to the new hive and leave the origin hive to build a new queen. Again, ask a beekeeper and you'll get 1,000 ways to do something. So if you could find the queen, take the queen, a frame of open brood, a frame of closed brood, a frame of honey, and a frame of honey and pollen. If you're counting, I believe that's 4 frames, and leave space for 1 open frame. And yes, that open frame should be something that is built out. In other words, comb. That's presupposing that you're using a 5-frame nuc. Of course, you could put that in a full size deep and put some extra frames in along it. Fundamentally, you're going to have the queen. You're going to have some brood to emerge to fill that box out. That's the cap stuff. You're going to have some queen laid eggs and larvae that will eventually get capped and be your future workforce while things are getting kicked off and replenished. And you'll have honey and you'll have pollen to work with so that they'll have something to eat while they get the new colony going. Depending on when you do this split, you will feed that colony to keep them going, or if you're in a nectar flow, they should be able to account for themselves. So the scenario I broke out was if you could find the queen, but if you can't find the queen, you could do it in reverse, but there's some nuance to that concept. First, you'll take the same frame types, but obviously not the queen. In other words, look to make sure the queen is not in your frames that you're transferring to your new hive. As a refresher, we said an open frame, a capped frame, a frame of honey, and a frame of honey and pollen, and then you're going to load in a drawn comb frame to round out the picture. Now, with this scenario where they're going to make their own queen, you're going to need nurse bees and ensure that you have enough to look after all the brood that you took over. I guess I could say for both methods, you're taking bees, if that wasn't obvious. You're going to need somebody to look after that brood comb that you're taking. So this split will raise a new queen if the brood has eggs that are 2 days or newer, as we talked about a little bit earlier. Hours old or days old are superior to 2 days old. Wait, let me say that again, because I think I said it wrong. Hours old or day old eggs are superior to 2 day old eggs, as we just discussed. Now, you have to keep in mind that if you're doing this and you're putting no queen in there, it'll take about a month, month and a half for the process to run its course. Because they have to build a queen, she has to go out and get mated, she has to come back in and lay. And one of the principles to this is you're taking new bees that are eggs, larvae, and you're taking bees that were covered and they will be the workforce for near-term and long-term. And with this, again, if it's non-forage time, you will want to feed this hive. Now, the thing with this is the time, speaking to you fellow New Jerseyans and people who are in the springtime in the U.S., for you folks overseas, you'll have to wait till your time period comes, but this is the time when you have the nectar flow and the spring flow on to do this. There's no better natural time to do this. You're going to force this on other times where you don't have it that you have to feed them. Can it be done? Sure. People make splits in June, July, August, and so on. As long as there's drone present, you could potentially be making splits, but now is the perfect time in the U.S. to be doing this. So one of the things you need to make sure of is you understand the loyalty of the workforce. The nurse bees are loyal to the brood. Foragers are loyal to the queen. If you take the foragers and nurse bees and move them to a new box, the following will likely be the result. The nurse bees will stay and care for their brood. The foragers will fly back to the origin hive if they have that opportunity. If you want to ensure that everybody stays put, move the split 3 miles out from the original apiary. So early in the season, you want to pay attention to the bee population so that if it gets cold, and I just talked about it, it's been colder than normal here in New Jersey, you want to make sure you have enough bees in that population to cool the brood or to keep the brood warm. If you have to, from the origin hive, because we had a lot of bees to start, you're going to shake all the nurse bees in, and if they don't have enough nurse bees in the mother hive, the bees that are there will turn back to nurse bees to keep everything in order. So split timing, when's the time to do this? Before swarms occur. Of course, you want to keep your bees. I said during nectar flows, in late summer is a consideration, but the workforce might be ramping down, or the provisions for overwinter will be smaller because they got a late start. The good news is if splits don't work, you could always kind of combine them back together. So another question you get about this splits basic is, I made a split, and now can I make another split? And then a split after that? I guess you have to consider the timing and the abundance of forage in your area and whether or not you could do that. There are folklore accounts of people splitting and splitting and splitting one hive into a dozen hives. Certainly doable, but you kind of have to understand the biology of what's going on and the surroundings and environment to see if you can pull it off. But make no mistake, splits negate honey. When you're making splits, split hives need to grow to be functional for overwintering. And whatever they accumulate from stores of nectar and pollen is basically going to get them to the point where they can overwinter. That being said, I've heard people make splits and then get a honey crop off of them, but I think you do not count on that as the rule. Last thing from a split's fundamental protection. Smaller colonies are not as equipped to protect themselves. During non-foraging time, you want to make sure that you are protecting them, as robbing is potential. These hives do not have the ability to protect themselves. Close the entrances and provide them the ability to guard what they have. So I'll stop there for this. If you want to know more about splits, you can go back and listen to past episodes. We've covered some of those in detail. There's also a lot of video and information out on the internet about those, so just do a little research and you'll find a lot of insights on that. You can also go back and recommend that you talk to your local beekeepers association and keep plugged in and possibly find a mentor there that can help you through some of the procedures. For segment number 3, I wanted to talk about a piece of equipment called a slatted rack. A slatted rack is a frame that you situate underneath your bottommost hive deep and right above the bottom board. The premise of this slatted rack is that it has a place for space. for the bees to operate, and also an insulating property right above the bottom board. There's discussion, and it'll go with the theme that we've had in this episode about coolness, that the bees do not work down in the bottom box when it's cold outside because the air coming in creates a chill for them, but the slatted rack creates that little insulation space of air that prevents the cold from getting in. And the byproduct of this is that the lower frames in the lowest box, the brood gets built all the way down to the bottom bar of the face, where a lot of times, if you go in and look, in the cooler climates and cooler temperatures, you'll see that the queen will not go down to that bottom area. The other aspect of a slotted rack is that it allows areas for bees to hang out. If you have a hive that is loaded, chock full with bees, and it's hot outside, they'll come out and beard on the outside. This could also be a swarm trigger, and giving the ability to have some extra space down in the bottom of the hive gives an area for bees to hang out, so to speak, and not get in the way. Now, some would say the slatted rack is creating a workspace detriment where bees coming in the hive have to pass through that space to get up to the comb, and it's a couple inches, and if you add that up by the thousands of trips and the thousands of bees, you're creating an inefficient society there, but that's where the opinion comes in. The question I have for you is, do you think a slatted rack is a valuable piece of equipment? So one of the things I didn't explain is that the slatted rack has an outer frame, and in between it has different boards separated. And when you slide it underneath this slatted rack, each one of those boards situates underneath a 10-frame hive situation. So if you have 10 frames in the box, they're spaced out with bee space, and the rack sits right underneath where the frame is. The space between each rack allows air to pass through and in between the different frames inside the box. Beekeepers assume that a slatted rack is going to work with a 10-frame hive situation, and that you're going to situate your 10 frames together in between the sidebars or the sides of your hive. In other words, when you look at 10 frames together in a deep box, if you squeeze them all together, there's space to the right and there's space to the left. Some beekeepers will slide them over to the left. Therefore, if they come in on the right side, they'll be able to pry that first frame over, and they'll have some room to move that frame and pull it up without rolling the bees against the outside. Other beekeepers will slide it all the way against the edge, the other side, and work away from themselves. And then again, most beekeepers generally will center the frames together in between the two sides of the hive. When you have a slatted rack, it kind of constrains you to follow the conventional principles. In my hives, I tend to work with 9 frames. I've seen 10-frame hives, and they have enough propolis in them that you can't even wedge a frame out of them sometimes. And I just like the little more room that 9 frames give you. You also tend to crush less bees, and when you're going gloveless, that's a factor that's in consideration. So what do you think about a slatted rack? I'd love to hear the opinion on this. I'm going to put a note up on our Facebook page asking if you've ever used one and what your experiences are and whether you would recommend it and why, or you would stay away from it and why. So go to Facebook.com/beekeeperscorner and weigh in and let us know what you think about the slatted rack. Is it a necessary piece of equipment, or is it a gadget that you don't need to have on your shelf? By the way, there's one more thing to add about this. The slatted rack is designed to go underneath the frames of your hive. We talked about it in the past where different manufacturers have different tolerances for how frames hang in a box. The slatted rack can go one way or the other, and in one of them you're making it shallow, very similar to the concept of an inner cover that has a deep side and a shallow side. And if you put it on the wrong way, meaning the slatted rack, you could potentially get him building bridge comb there. So make sure when you buy one and you employ one that you put it in the box the right way. Segment number 4, we want to talk about international queen marking color codes. believe we've mentioned this, but every spring it makes sense to discuss this as new beekeepers and or seasoned veterans alike need a little reminder or refresher on the queen marking colors. Marking a queen is really advantageous, especially when you're starting to think about how long a queen has been in there and whether or not the queen you're staring at in the box is the same one that you've been working with all along. Marking them with paint is relatively simple, but it requires a little bit of practice, and I'll give you a hint on that in just a moment. So the color for the year ending in 4, or 2014, is green. And if you're looking at the queens from last year, they should be marked with red, and the year before they should be marked with yellow. You can go to a store and buy specific paint for marking queens. You can order them out of beekeeping catalogs or so on, or you could use model car paint. The mark should be small so that it doesn't cover a large part of the queen. You're really looking for maybe a little dot of paint on the thorax. Now, the funny thing about this is that probably the most daunting part is how do you get a queen up off the comb and into marker? And for this, there are gadgets available. You could find these little clasp-like pinchers that you go through and you pinch and pick up your queen. You can find these tube-shaped ones with a little soft padding, and you scoop her up and confine her. Or you can literally just pick her up, hold her in your hand, and dab her with paint. Now, I just said something that seems rather strange. You're talking about the mother of the hive, and you don't want to damage her. How in tarnation do you pick her up? Well, it comes to reason that she has a pair of handles. And by that, we're talking about her wings. There's a great video out on YouTube of Michael Palmer discussing how to do this, where he reaches down and he grabs the wings of the bee, the queen, and he picks her up, and then with his other hand, he kind of clamps over her head and her thorax, and he paints her, and then he just puts her right back down. How do you do that? That's a really daunting task, new or seasoned veteran alike. Here's the tip. Pick up some drones. Boys don't sting, and they're very easy to catch. They're big, and you could practice painting drones until you get comfortable with it, and then go get your queen. Another thing you could do is buy the tube contraption that I discussed, which has like a little foam plunger. You could literally just coax her off the comb to walk inside, and you pick her up, and you hold her tight with the spongy, foamy piece, and you could paint her thorax, and then you could leave her by to dry. Because one of the things, once you mark her, is you don't want to put her in right away, especially if the paint is wet, is the queen's court will come and clean her up and get rid of that paint. I said in the opening for the local hive report that I found our queen. I knew it was her because she was marked. And she was marked with yellow, which means she was 2 years old, and they had chewed most of the paint off, but it was recognizable enough to know that that was the mark queen we started with. So mark your queens, and if you're ever confused about what color this year is, you can go out and look for queen marking color codes on the internet. You could always find that resource available to you. One other thing about this is sometimes people think that the proper way to do this, and your mileage may vary, is to clip the queen's wings. Premise of this is you clip the wing and you know that she's a marked queen and she cannot fly away. If, however, she does try to swarm at some point and she flies out, she's going to go out and land in front of the hive and she's not going to make it, and you're dooming the swarm. So, I don't know. I never thought that made any sense to me, but your choice as to how you do it. It's your bees. Okay. It's time for the roundtable part of the episode. You know, some days you have the gift of gab and other days you can't string together a sentence. I think I'm somewhere in the middle tonight, but I'll keep forging on. So you'll have to bear with me on some of my broken thoughts here. But the first one, roundtable, is called Why? This is a fascinating topic in its own right. You know, there's an interesting thread recently on a forum evaluating the methods of a successful beekeeping procedure and the method in use. I'm being generic as to explain the situation, but not accusing anybody. But it's a beekeeper who's one of the most insightful and contributing individuals to the beekeeping community. And let's just leave it at that. You know, a response in the pages of the debate had what I considered to be one of the most poignant responses about people and the way they were behaving to this individual. And the subject of the debate was people demanding an explanation for how this procedure could work for that one person, but lo and behold, it did not work for them. The insightful answer the person suggested the right way to approach this is not to demand an explanation, but inquire as to why. And I love the spirit of that because it hits close to home here, especially after some of the commentary of our last episode. You know, I don't blame those who are having success, and it seems counterproductive to suggest or doubt another one's success, even if the tactics don't yield the same results. It's frustrating, sure. I've heard no less than 5 different methods that are professed for sure-fire results in the way that you approach to keep bees with minimal losses and large yields. Small cell, 3 boxes, work with feral bees, management techniques, and more, all are the easy path to foolproof beekeeping. I said this recently and I've discussed it with others. Our state apiarist has demonstrated that in New Jersey, those who don't treat lose their bees. And I have to wonder if there are factors in play in different regions. For example, we live near Route 95. 95 is a path to the north, and many of the bees going north for pollination roll right through our area. Some even stop in various sites in New Jersey for blueberry pollination. Are those bees impacting the quality or longevity of the stock? And I hate to say this about the commercial guys, but the commercial guys are running bees for a business. And sometimes their practices are counterintuitive, but they just make more bees. They have resources to do that. So maybe that's an impact. Are there areas where beekeeping operations thrive because they live in relative isolation from others? And in New York State and some of these other areas, maybe the Arizona situation, that's what's going on. Who knows? Are there environmental conditions like large stands of woods with feral bees that favor certain operations? Density of population. Per mile, New Jersey is one of the most densely populated states in the United States. We live smack dab in the middle of New York and Philadelphia. Are we in New Jersey simply dumb beekeepers? And we're subject to the Dunning-Kruger principle. Yeah, Dunning-Kruger. What the heck is that? If you've never heard of it, and I'm paraphrasing, it's the one who is oblivious and unskilled. They suffer from the illusion that thinking they know it all and shun any insights of others, thereby keeping themselves, in essence, incompetent. So maybe Kevin, as an example, is a know-it-all. Even though people are trying to explain it to him, it's just not getting through. So I'm sure hope that I'm smart enough to not overestimate my own level of skill, that I can't see the genuine genius in others, and that I am not oblivious to the fact that I'm adult about beekeeping. Because if all of those things were true, then the Dunning-Kruger principle is in effect. And that when others demonstrate to me in simple terms my misgivings, I'm too stupid to realize it. No, I hope that's not me. I must say, and I hope that if you've been following along this journey, you'll agree, we consistently strive to make our box a little bigger around here. Someday, somehow, I think I'm going to find a path to the principles that others have. I was recently listening to Gary from Kiwimana and the podcast that he has interviewing Linda Tillman, who lives in the center of Atlanta, and she is treatment-free. It gives me pause to think that there's possibility for that here, but thus far no one seems to have found that formula in New Jersey. But we continue to strive for it, and we hope that we can get there someday. So to the person who responded in defense of the beekeeper who was expressing their means and methods and having success while everybody was in the forum punching holes and throwing accusations and accusing someone of distrust, God bless for coming to the defense and saying it's not a question of telling somebody they're wrong, but to understand why they are right or what you can learn from it. Good for them. Roundtable number two, I wanted to give you an access to a resource available about bees, wasps, and hornets, and a brochure that the New Jersey Beekeepers Association puts out to people to make them aware of what the differences are in these things. You know, when we're speaking, so for example, yesterday at Earth Day, while we had the booth and the table, people walk up and ask, how do they get rid of carpenter bees? How do they tell a wasp versus a hornet? How do you tell a child who is deathly afraid to go outside because they're thinking that they're going to be stung by an insect? How do you handle all that? Now, this doesn't give you all the answers to some of those things, but as far as bees, wasps, hornets go, it gives you an introduction to how to deal with them, what they are, what they look like, what their habitat is, and so on. And as a beekeeper, I can assure you, as we've discussed in the past, that you will face these questions, and it is a good resource to have. If you want to see our brochure at the New Jersey level and possibly look at getting one for your state, you can go to New Jersey NJ, that is, beekeepers.org. Let me do that correctly. www.njbeekeepers.org/site_docs/bwasphornet.pdf. And of course, we'll provide a link in the show notes. In the brochure, you'll see something about wasps and hornets. It explains yellow jackets, bumblebees, carpenter bees, and of course, honeybees. It talks about the importance of pollinators. And it also goes into bald-faced hornets, paper red wasps, mud daubers, which, by the way, found on my garage this week, and cicada killers, along with some other information. So pretty nice little brochure. If you don't have one for your state or you need one for your beekeepers association, by all means, take a look. And if you're not familiar with all of these things, as a beekeeper, you will be asked about this, so it makes sense to go take a peek and get up to speed. I also know that one of our past episodes we covered in detail a different guide, so you can go back and check our archives for some more insight on that if you are so interested. For roundtable number three, this one's for you to help me out. I have an iPad, I have a Microsoft Surface issued from work, I have a Windows phone, I have access to Android and iPhones. And a lot of times at work, we end up testing devices. And what would be more interesting for me in the malaise of testing, to have the ability to see the beekeeping apps that you have at your disposal. I know of a couple, but I don't even share them because they seem to think that they are not very compelling. The only one that I think is relevant is HiveTrax, which is a very good application. And a lot of people, or a handful of people I know, keep track of their bees in there. So you can Google or Bing that, HiveTrax. But I want to hear from you. Send me a note, kevin@bkcorner.org, or go over to our Facebook page, facebook.com/beekeeperscorner, and let us know what beekeeping apps you have come across. I don't know if it's for the PC, for the phone, for the tablet, but I'm interested in hearing about all of them. And in our next episode, if I get a handful of them as suggestions, I will let you know what the outcome was. So send in your apps. We want to know what they have, because there is an app for that. And I would love to hear what's available out there. So let's crowdsource this, everybody. Roundtable number four. This enters into the realm of idiotic ideas, I suppose. It's lip balm for kicks. So there's a lip balm out there made by Burt's Bees, which is a astonishingly good product, and we have them in the house, even though we make our own lip balm from our own wax and products in here, we still buy theirs. One of them comes with peppermint oil as an ingredient, and when you put it on your lips, there's a little bit of a tingle. And adolescent youth and even young adults have taken to putting this product on their eyelids as an entertaining factor. It's called beezing. It's been covered in the mainstream press recently. They're doing it to keep themselves awake, to have a little stimulation, and perhaps when they're imbibing in different chemicals and beverages, to get a little bit of a sensation to heighten their little buzz that they have going. Buzz being the operative word there. The bad news is this is not a good practice for you. They're taking this stuff and rubbing it on their eyelids, and they're subject to whatever was on the product from putting it on your lips, creating infections in your eyes, and potentially damaging it. As the FDA or any other regulatory agency would tell you, do not use these products for things they're not labeled for. Nothing to do with Burt's Bees. It's just misuse by people who are misguided. I guess at the end of the day, and I'm going to be lamented for saying this, but I'll be pragmatic about it. It probably isn't that harmful. It'll probably be a fad. It'll go away. But the bad news is that it could potentially lead to serious eye problems, and it should not be condoned. Why share this and sensationalize it? It's really just a matter of awareness, because again, as ambassadors of beekeeping, you're going to hear about this stuff. Somebody may mention it at work, and lo and behold, hopefully you don't find your children with this practice, and perhaps it could come up in conversation and explain why this is not a good idea. So just a little public service announcement for everybody to let you know this is going on. That's really the intention of sharing. For roundtable number 5, I want to talk about a pollen color guide. If you go to Wikipedia, you can find a pollen source guide. It's at en.wikipedia.org/wiki/pollen_source. Very interesting resource. You can get a list of different plants and the description of their pollen qualities, including the color that's available to let you identify when you see things going inside your hive where it could potentially have been sourced from. Someone shared a pollen chart that was used that information and other information, and it comes with a literal grid like a honeycomb. And it shows different colors from a very lemony yellow all the way to a chocolate brown, some of the greens, some of the oranges. And under each color, it shows when that particular pollen or the plant is in session. In other words, is it a spring plant, a summer plant, or an autumn plant? And what the color is, and certainly the name. So dandelion, for example, is like a middle-of-the-road orange. If you look at wild honeysuckle in the summertime, it's a lemony yellow. If you look at marjoram, which is available as a autumn plant, it's a bit of a army green. And you can go all the way to lupin or red dead nettle, which is a spring plant that is red like a blood red. And in between. So there's a lot of neat things that you'll recognize. And if you start seeing some of those green pollens coming in, either in the spring, the summer, or the autumn, you could tell what they are, because green always becomes an interesting thing. And even the blue ones that go through. So the link to this is at Kent, KentBee.com, KentBee.com. You could find the pollen chart. It's a deep path link, so I'll provide a link to the PDF in the show notes for it. Very neat resource to have on hand. So we're to the point where I guess we're getting to roundtable number 6, and I think I'll combine number 6 and closing comments since we've just crossed the hour mark for this episode. Yesterday and this week upcoming, literally is Earth Day, but yesterday, as I've mentioned, we had our Earth Day booth. We also had a hands-on session at the Mentoring Hives where we talked to new and seasoned beekeepers alike about spring management, swarm prevention. We performed some splits that resulted in the hives that I mentioned on the outset. I have to say, two things strike me about the day. One is talking to the public. It's just fascinating to teach the little kids the wonder that they have looking at the observation hive and the things that they see that you never notice about that. It always astonishes me when they ask a question that you never heard before and how they manage to do that. Love interacting with the public. I love educating the public and just hearing what they have to say and their perceptions. And it makes you think about the greater good for bees in the world when you start talking to the public and you realize that aspect of it as you discuss different facets of beekeeping and their impact to nature, especially on Earth Day. Yesterday we stood in front of, 30, 35 people talking about raising bees and raising hands of the audience in there. Who has new bees? Who has bees that overwintered? And the mix of people who are brand new and still haven't gotten their bees yet, but looking in anticipation. The opening of this episode was centered on that just optimistic enthusiasm that they have, and it's infectious. I love this time of year. I love to talk to new beekeepers. I love the, you know, the questions that they have and the honesty and the ingenuity that they come up with and their preconceived notions, and talking to them and hearing their ideas. You also like to catch up with old friends who you haven't seen, and they come to the first spring meeting in earnest. And there's nothing better than getting into bees. Yesterday, of course, we didn't have any bees on the property other than what was going on with that one kind of oddball hive. And you start to doubt whether you dive into a box of bees, whether it's still there, but it's like riding a horse. It was really enjoyable to look at the patterns and find the queen and talk to everybody about this is an egg and this is a larvae and so on. So very big advocate for the beekeeping education side of the thing, of the business, so to speak, and the Beekeepers Association and making new beekeepers. It's funny when you look at people and you say, that person right there is on their journey to become a lifelong beekeeper. You could just read it in their eyes and their passion and their methods. Even from the outset, you can kind of pick those people out. We saw at least a half dozen people that I know will become lifelong studies of the bees. And it's just neat. It's just a neat thing that I think we underappreciate. So if you're a new beekeeper, welcome to the fraternity. We really enjoy having you. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Hopefully we're giving you good information, and hopefully you're finding your own path in this world. If you're a seasoned beekeeper and just here, I say welcome back. Thank you for supporting the podcast, for sending the notes. I know sometimes I'm silent, but I really do appreciate the community that comes and listens and likes to talk bees, and we'll continue to do this. It is a very, very busy period of time, especially at work. I can't believe what's going on. So I'll try to keep the episodes going. I know there's a little gap here since the last one, but, you know, it's beekeeping season, so we're excited about it. We want to stay engaged, so we'll see that we can keep things going. So stop mumbling, Kevin. Thanks, everybody. We enjoy talking to you and look forward to the next episode. Have a good time. Enjoy your bees and be well.